Roundtable Podcasts, underwritten by Proctors, the Capital Region's premier performing arts center featuring the best in entertainment from Broadway and around the globe. Proctors.org.
60 years after the Supreme Court's historic decision in Brown versus the Board of Education, public education in America remains largely separate and unequal. Race-based affirmative action, one of the major efforts aimed at restoring the imbalance in access to education and opportunity, has been divisive and largely ineffective and is routinely challenged in court and at the state ballot box, where voters have uniformly banned the policy. Now in the new book, Place, Not Race, A New Vision of Opportunity in America, Cheryl Cashin, professor of law at Georgetown University, calls for an end to race-based affirmative action in university admissions. She argues that affirmative action based only on race too often helps dark-skinned students who are already advantaged, including well-educated African elites and Cosby kids, while bypassing achievers from poor neighborhoods and schools who are truly deserving of special consideration. Again, the name of the book is Place, Not Race, A New Vision of Opportunity in America, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Cheryl Cashin to the program. Cheryl, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Before we talk about your argument in the book, what do you make of this anniversary, of the 60th anniversary of Brown versus the Board of Education, and what we've learned in that six decades since?
Well, we have learned that integration works, actually, where it is achieved. I personally was a great beneficiary of well-integrated, high-quality public schools. And when we are able to achieve that, it works for low-income kids of all colors, where they can access the resources, and it doesn't harm privileged kids. And actually, a lot of privileged kids learn from being around kids who don't have as much as they are. All the studies show that the best way for a low-income kid of any color to learn and excel is to be in a school where a majority of the kids are middle class. And for a while, the country was making good on the promise of Brown, but since 1980, we've been slowly retreating, and actually vastly retreating in more recent decades, returning to neighborhood schools. And unfortunately, what's happened in American society is only 42% of all Americans today live in a middle-class neighborhood, and that's down from 65% in 1970. Why is that? Because affluent people and highly educated people increasingly are segregated into their own neighborhoods. And so black and Latino kids suffer the most from this rising segregation of the affluent, but any kid who lives outside of what I call these gold standard neighborhoods, and all of your listeners know where the gold standard neighborhoods are, is outside of the highest opportunity tracks. And that's why I'm arguing place, not race, that if you live in a gold standard neighborhood, you automatically have access to highly selective, high-quality K through 12 education that sets you up very well to go into selective higher education. And everybody else outside those neighborhoods and networks has a much more difficult time. Doesn't have as well-resourced schools, as many excellent teachers, and I think universities have an ethical obligation to pay attention to that and to give special consideration to high-achieving kids from low-opportunity settings.
It seems like race-based affirmative action started out with the best of intentions. So what went wrong?
Well, when affirmative action was born in the 60s, it was the case that there was a lot of exclusion based on race in American society. It was absolutely the case that to be African American or Latino, and in some circumstances Asian, Native American too, that we had a society where institutions had excluded people who weren't white, and so you needed affirmative efforts to change that. But if you fast forward to today, to be African-American or to be a minority doesn't by definition mean you're disadvantaged, you know. Obama says this, right? My own kids, frankly, my kids are so privileged some days I can barely stand them. They have the best of everything, right? So I'm arguing that affirmative action should be returned to its original purpose of helping people who were excluded and who were disadvantaged. And frankly, there are a lot of people who are disadvantaged in American society. There are a lot of struggling white folks. And we need to, I prefer strategies that promote diversity in a way that that builds alliances between people of color and struggling white folks rather than causing resentment between them.
You write in the book that the son of an African World Bank executive or the daughter of a black president counts the same in terms of optics and is easier to admit than the son or daughter of a black policeman. So what do we do for the policeman?
Well, it depends on where the son or the daughter of the policeman lives. I mean, and yes, what I'm saying is I'm indicting elite institutions of higher education where you can see optical diversity, but below the surface, often there's not that much diversity in terms of the backgrounds of the kids. The son of a black policeman, I'm not saying that that person should automatically get a preference because they're black. I'm saying that schools should pay attention to where high-achieving kids come from. And a high-achieving kid in a low-resource school, whatever their color, they may be in a school with no AP courses or only a few, and they're competing with kids who may be in a school that have 20 AP classes. And I'm saying that the admissions process should pay attention to those differences, and the kid in a high achieving kid in a low resource school is deserving of special consideration. No one is deserving of special consideration just because of the color of their skin, and nor, frankly, is someone deserving of special consideration just because their parent is a legacy.
You say there are many high achieving kids with grit, trapped in circumstances beyond their control. What they need most is not affirmative action, but fair systems of opportunity and a college admissions process that does not exclude them. You were just talking about the college admissions process.
Right.
What do we need to do to change that?
Right. Well, in addition to considering place, not race, I'm arguing that the admissions process should be scrubbed of any practices that reinforce advantage and really aren't related to merit. Standardized tests should be optional. Financial aid should go back to being based solely on need, not so-called merit. Legacy preferences should be scrapped, as should race preferences, and that admissions officers should screen for the factors that truly predict success. The number one predictor of success in college is the cumulative GPA of at high school, and the second factor, grit, the willingness to do the work. And there are ways to screen for that. The kid that is willing to get up at 4 a.m. and do the work, there are kids with grit and resilience out there. And people who get a 4.0 in high school, by the way, they tend to repeat that performance. They're setting extremely high standards for themselves. So it's not true that you can't find kids of color, low-income white kids who are high-achieving. Universities have to go about a different way of finding these kids.
You make the point in the book, and I found it to be a fascinating one, about the influence of U.S. News and World Report's rankings, that you believe overvalue standardized test scores and ultimately don't weigh diversity.
Right. I mean, actually, U.S. News and World Report drives much of admissions practices. Everybody pays attention to the ranking of their school. Alumni pay attention, and admissions officers and administrators certainly do. And so the U.S. News and World Report puts great value on the median SAT scores of the entering class. The thing that SAT scores most predict is the income of the parents of the children who took the test. They predict very little else about how a kid will do in college. And that's not fair, and it doesn't count as merit. And so we're overemphasizing SAT scores. Most kids, frankly, who have above 1100, the research shows, are capable of doing the work in elite higher education. Meanwhile, U.S. News & World Report gives no points to being socioeconomically diverse or racially diverse. And so what universities do, they want diversity. Everybody wants diversity to a certain degree, but have to play this game of, well, how much am I willing to let my median SAT score go down for that? And that has nothing to do with merit, in my mind.
I think one of the lines you have in the book that is so important is, if whites are to engage with diversity rather than resentant, the rules of competition must be perceived as fair to them and everyone else. Are you optimistic that we're making the rules more fair?
Well, we're in a really tough place, aren't we, Joe? I mean,
yes.
I don't think American society works for the vast majority of people of all colors today. American society works for the already advantaged, right? You see that in the workplace. You know, there's only 17 counties in the country where more than half of the people in those counties have a college degree. The successful and the highly educated are segmenting into their networks, and it's very hard, if you're not born into those networks today, to succeed and prosper and get access to opportunity. And so what I'm trying to do with this book beyond reforming affirmative action and making it better and fairer, I'm trying to start a dialogue in which struggling white folks see the commonalities between their condition and people of color, and people of color and progressives connect the dots with them, and that we get what I'd like to see is, a multiracial majority for sanity, you know, get us at least to 55% of people where we cohere around fair policies that invest in K-12 education everywhere, that expand opportunity to everyone, to the broad middle class.
The name of the book is Place, Not Race, A New Vision of Opportunity in America. The book is published by Beacon Press. Cheryl Cashin, a great pleasure to have you on the program, and thank you very much for sharing your expertise with us.
Thank you for having me.
That's a great pleasure. Thank you. Again, the title of the book is Place, Not Race, A New Vision of Opportunity in America. The book is published by Beacon Press. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.